You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 12th of August, 2025, and thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear, peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and today in the studio we've got Juliet, and we've also got Elena. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I hope everyone is doing well this morning. Just wanted to quickly start today's program just to acknowledge that some of our colleagues, fellow journalists in Gaza that were part of the Al Jazeera team were killed by a targeted Israeli attack on Sunday evening. So just wanted to start today's show by acknowledging the work of journalists Anas Al-Sharif, Mohammed Kreker, Ibrahim Zahir, Mohammed Nufal, and Muhammad Aliwa. There was also a freelance reporter, Mohammed Al-Khaldi, who was also killed. And we will be sharing one of the speeches from last night's snap rally outside the ABC later in the show. But we just wanted to start this morning by acknowledging our fellow journalists in Gaza who were killed over the weekend. So perhaps we can start by having a chat about what's coming up on today's program. So at 7:15, we'll be speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and she'll be on the program this morning to chat about the latest Productivity Commission report into AI. Basically, they're calling for a pause on regulation, and so Lucinda will be talking to us about how that benefits big tech and the impacts that will have on everyday people.
And then at 7:30, we're going to be chatting to Nina, who is the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out, which is a community organisation focused on keeping women and gender diverse people to help them get out of prison and stay out of prison. And we're going to be chatting about the organisation's work and how they engage survivors who've experienced incarceration and their recent presentation in Alice Springs about economic reintegration. Then at 7:45, we're going to be chatting to Kath Rouse from the No Northern Incinerator campaign to get some campaign updates and to hear about the upcoming EPA decision on the incinerator and how the community is organising in the lead up to that.
And then at 8 o'clock, we'll be sharing an excerpt from the Women's Climate Conference that took place earlier this year in Castle, Maine. This first aired on Earth Matters at the end of July. And in this audio, you'll hear Beck presenting five speakers who represent students, rural women, First Nations women, women with disabilities, and older women as they share their experiences of how to bring marginalized voices into climate discussions, negotiations, and decisions in order to achieve better outcomes. And then at 8:15, as I mentioned earlier, we will hear Noor speak at last night's snap rally outside the ABC headquarters in South Bank. It was organized by the Free Palestine Coalition, NAM, in response to the targeted airstrikes by Israel that killed Palestinian journalists. And in her speech, Noor reads out the will and final words of Anas al-Sharif. So that is our show for this morning. Hopefully you stick around until 8:30 a.m. But for now, we'll be back with the news headlines after this.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later,
you're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. And these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 12th of August, 2025.
As the Australian government announces its intention to recognise the State of Palestine, the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network warns that this recognition is being used to deflect from the urgent legal obligations Australia must uphold under the Genocide Convention to shield Israel from legal accountability for its genocide and apartheid, and to normalise relations with the apartheid genocidal state. This recognition comes while Israel is committing an ongoing genocide in Gaza, which has been live-streamed for the world for almost 2 years. APAN has called out the meaningless nature of this recognition as Australia continues to arms, trade with, diplomatically protect, and encourage other states to normalize relations with the very state perpetrating these atrocities, and with Israeli leaders wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes. They reiterated how Palestinian rights are not a gift to be granted by Western states, nor are they crumbs to be thrown to Palestinians by Western states in lieu of taking the real action they are legally bound to take under the Genocide Convention.
Also in the news, the United Nations Human Rights Committee has urgently requested that the Albanese government not remove a man from Australia to Nauru while the committee investigates the human rights implications of the planned deportation. The Iraqi man, represented by the Human Rights Law Centre, filed a complaint with the UN committee after the Albanese government announced plans to permanently exile him and two other people to Nauru in the first exercise of the new third country deportation laws introduced in November 2024. The complaint argues that by sending the man to Nauru, Australia would breach its international legal obligations not to deport him to a place where he may face death or cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. Refugees previously sent to Nauru by Australia have been killed and suffered violence, medical neglect and discrimination. In Nauru, the man would also face the risk of being returned to Iraq, where he faces persecution and would be permanently separated from his family. Josephine Langbian, Associate Director at the Human Rights Law Centre, has said that the planned deportations show that the Albanese government believes that some people in this country deserve fewer rights than others, and that these deportations set a dangerous new baseline for how migrants and refugees are treated. In other news this week, welfare recipients and community sector organisations are calling for an urgent intervention by the government to stop Centrelink payment suspensions that cause severe financial hardship and turmoil in the lives of poor people. Last week, the Commonwealth Ombudsman released the first of its report into the investigation of the administration of the compulsory activities known as mutual obligations. Maladministration of the targeted compliance framework has caused thousands of welfare recipients to have their Centrelink payment reduced and cancelled unlawfully, though the full scale of payment impacts is not currently quantifiable. For example, nearly 350,000 payment suspensions were issued just in the first quarter of 2025, affecting more than 280,000 people out of the roughly 800,000 who had requirements during the period. The Ombudsman's investigation commenced in February 2025 and exposes disturbing failures on behalf of the Department of Employment and Workforce Relations and Services Australia that show total disregard for the lives and well-being of welfare recipients, which cause catastrophic consequences for hundreds of people. And finally, in headlines, yesterday, 11th of August, a new report released by a coalition of unions and environmental orgs, including Greenpeace, put out a report called WA Can't Wait, which recommended the need for a decommissioning hub to address increasing numbers of retired offshore oil and gas infrastructure. The report found that building the hub could create thousands of secure jobs for skilled workers to enable circular supply chains for steel and other materials, as well as green recycling, thereby protecting marine ecosystems and coastal communities. Close to 90% of Australia's 5.7 million tonnes of material in offshore oil and gas infrastructure is found in WA, according to the report. The analysis posed that oil and gas companies would be held liable to fund cleanup efforts. Fern Cadman, the Wilderness Society fossil fuel industry campaigner, urged the need for the decommissioning as Australia and WA are already behind the eight ball on decommissioning. The longer we wait, the harder the work is and the more the environment is at risk. We hope this report is a kick into gear for governments and industry. The magnificent oceans of WA mustn't become an industrial wasteland for the oil and gas sector. Cleaning up the legacy of the offshore oil and gas industry is a responsibility and an opportunity. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 12th of August, 2025, and you're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from SoCord Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
Hello, this is Chloe Allison Escott of the Native Cats. And you are listening very closely, I hope. to 3CR.
Welcome back to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au. We are joined this morning by Lucinda Thorpe, who is a privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. And Lucinda joins us this morning to chat about the latest Productivity Commission report on AI, how big tech companies will benefit from a lack of regulation, and how this will impact regular people. Welcome to 3CR, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me on. It is a pleasure to be here this morning.
Thank you so much for joining us so early in the morning. I was wondering if you could start by explaining your role to our listeners just in a bit more detail. What do you do as privacy campaigner at DRW?
Great question. So as privacy campaigner, I advocate for better privacy reform regarding like the Privacy Act that we have here in Australia. And I also help within the organisation to advise the government on how to better protect the privacy of Australians.
Okay, so you're very well placed then to talk about, I guess, the topic that we're discussing today, which is looking at the regulation of AI. And so, yeah, let's get into it. The Productivity Commission released their interim report called Harnessing Data and Digital Technology. I was wondering if you could just give a brief summary of some of the main findings in this report or anything that really struck you after reading this.
Yeah, absolutely. So firstly, a bit of context. The Productivity Commission is an independent advisory body to the Australian government and was created by Parliament in 1998 to replace the Industry Commission. Now, as you said, on the 5th of August, they published their interim report, and it was largely about AI. Now, the main message of the report emphasised the economic value of using AI tech. For example, companies can use AI to better model competitors, and that will increase competition in the market. Now, the report warns against regulation, which might impede these economic gains. Now, everyone loves a healthy economy boost, so why are AI experts and civil society groups such as ours disappointed? Well, it has to do with a few ideas that they float in there, but also just the general message really missed the mark for us. Because firstly, it completely ignored public opinion. Independent research shows that 64% of Australians want stronger regulatory safeguards around AI, and 83% they would say they would trust AI more if proper protections were in place. And the report just does not reflect those community concerns. In fact, the report actively prioritises interests of large US-based AI companies over the rights and safety of Australian workers and citizens. Now, this is because the basis of the report assumes economic benefits when they actually aren't guaranteed. The projected economic boost relies on Australian companies adopting AI to improve productivity and profits. But much of the wealth that is generated by that AI adoption will flow to the corporations which own the AI, and they're mostly in the US and China. The resulting profit increases for Australian companies will partly come from AI-fueled cost-cutting measures, such as replacing workers with AI, meaning that these economic gains won't necessarily reach ordinary Australians. In fact, they might actually disadvantage them. Now, this is massive, and the report really just skims over this. And without regulation, AI can pose serious human rights issues, from the content they're capable of generating all the way to the biases that they can perpetuate. So a regulation as a last resort approach to AI is a really big red flag for groups like ours.
Yeah, thank you so much for that summary of the report. It's really interesting that you note that these so-called economic benefits won't actually positively impact many everyday people, but instead flow to the big tech companies overseas that are already making so much money and accumulating so much wealth from this technology. I wanted to go into the regulation of AI in a bit more detail. Can you talk about what that would potentially look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we're saying the word regulation of AI, it can sound really boring, but it has some pretty serious real-life impacts. For example, the Commission warns against introducing technology-specific regulations and suggests that the government should rely on existing laws instead. So this means applying existing legislation to entirely new scenarios. And this is a mistake. AI's revolver is evolving so rapidly and its capabilities are so unique that existing legislation just doesn't cover many of the harms it causes. For example, deepfake technology. Currently, under sections of the Criminal Code 1995, it's an offence to use a carriage service in a way that's menacing, harassing, or offensive. There's also civil action a victim of a deepfake might take, but there's currently no laws prohibiting the actual creation of the deepfake software, or the act of creating a deepfake and then distributing it. So unless they fit the existing narrow definitions, it leaves huge gaps in protection, particularly for women and children. An AI free-for-all might sound like equality in action, but in practice, unregulated AI models amplify existing biases and can become really powerful means of oppression and harassment. So when we're talking about AI regulation, we're talking about how it's created. We're talking about putting safeguards in place to actually restrict those biases and make it so the people who are using AI, which is essentially everyone today, even if you don't know it, if you use Google Translate, you talk to Siri in your car, you even do a Google search, you're using AI, so this affects you. And these broader regulations on how AI is created has a massive trickle-down effect to how it's used by people in the day-to-day and the effects that it has.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Lucinda. You were saying before that obviously this will have a big impact, without the regulation of AI, this will have a big impact on everyday people. You mentioned, you know, a lot of the so-called profits would end up going to big companies and potentially disadvantage Australian workers. But from your work as a privacy campaigner, can you tell us a bit more about how the privacy of everyday people would be affected by a lack of regulation of these technologies?
Yeah, absolutely. So one example of a privacy concern has to do with technology and data mining. And this is something that the report actually floats. It says maybe a technology and data mining exemption for big tech would be a good idea. Now, what this means is data mining uses advanced algorithms and computing techniques to sift through large volumes of raw data. So I'm talking everything from novels to social media, maybe even your posts, journal articles, blogs you might have written, and even copyrighted material as well. And allowing AI to access this data and train using it with zero restraint results in industrialized level of copyright infringement and an acceleration of mass data extraction and corporate surveillance as well. Because what it does is it makes the data that companies are holding on you even more valuable because they can then give that to AIs and that AI can use it. So it's incentivizing companies to hold even more data and essentially surveil, which is really problematic for our privacy. And this has already caused enormous problems for our democracy by proliferating disinformation in our civic spaces and creates enormous cybersecurity risks, as millions of Australians that are already caught up in data breaches know all too well. Now, another point is that AI is advancing so quickly. Scientists from OpenAI, Anthropic and Meta and other leading AI developers recently published a paper where they all agreed, which is really rare, warning that we are close to losing the ability to understand how some AI systems actually make decisions, meaning we're not going to know how they're reaching the decisions they make. We don't know what data, or we might not soon know, the data that they're using. And that is really problematic because there could be all sorts of privacy invasions within that.
Yeah, that sounds quite terrifying, and it seems like an issue that is continuing to evolve. So just quickly, Lucinda, before you leave us for today, if there are people listening who want to learn more about their rights as people who use the internet and technology and AI, where can they go to find out more information or to understand these systems a bit better?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. So please head over to our website at Digital Rights Watch, where we have tons of explainers to help you understand. We are actually also hosting an event today, Stolen Property, Big Tech's Push to Mine Our Culture. It's free. You just have to register. And that's running today online from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. So if you're feeling inspired this morning, you can spend your afternoon learning a little more about it.
Well, thank you so much for that, Lucinda. I'm sure we'll have you on again to continue this conversation about how we can better protect ourselves against big tech. But for now, thanks so much for joining us on 3CR Tuesday Breakfast.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
So we've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. And just to let you know about that website again that Lucinda just mentioned to us, it is digitalrightswatch.org.au. So head there if you would like to find out more information. We are going to play a song for you now. This is the latest single from Naam-based Palestinian singer-songwriter Yara, and it's called Common Sense.
That's just common sense. So use your words, I'm down to converse. Can't let down my walls. When you're pulling up more, just sitting on defense. And you'd rather pretend that it's not your fault, but you love to benefit. Yeah, that's the illusion. You're part of the show. Black and mirrors. And you don't smell no smoke. Protecting yourself can look me in the eyes when we should endear. So why should I be sorry for your indifference, baby? Then common sense. Oh, you'd rather leave it.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinina. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Dja Dja Rong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
Up next, we are speaking to Nina, who is the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out. And Flat Out is a community-based organisation focused on helping women and gender-diverse people to get out and stay out of prison. And Nina's here to chat about Flat Out's work, how they engage survivors who've experienced incarceration, and Flat Out's recent presentation in Alice Springs, Mabantwa, about economic reintegration. Welcome to 3CR, Nina.
Hi, how you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. Thanks so much for getting up early to chat to us, Nina. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you came to be working for Flat Out?
Yeah, sure. First, I'll just acknowledge that I am on the land of the Bunurong people of the Eastern Kulin Nations in a place called Malau, which is otherwise known as Phillip Island. And that it always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So my name's Nina. I'm the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out. I've been there for about 3 years and was working as a lived experience advocate across the sector, predominantly in the justice space and family violence space because of my lived experience. So I'm formerly incarcerated and also a survivor of intimate partner violence and also of state violence. And I just want to make that really clear because a lot of the time we look at prisons and, you know, the narrative is that they provide safety for community, but they're actually really, really violent places and warehouse bodies and are places of torture. And there are heaps better alternatives to prisons. I was one of the folks that were incarcerated because of the last bail laws.
Mm-hmm.
I was suffering a drug addiction and also was experiencing family violence. And so I would have, it would have been a lot more beneficial for myself, for community, for my loved ones, for my children and for my family if I have gotten support for the family violence that I was experiencing and also for the substance use that I was using to self-medicate and gain some distance from myself and be able to detach from my current experience. I actually think that the drug use is what kept me alive during my family violence experience. And, yeah, I just see consistently that policing is stealing money from our communities. We spend so much money in Victoria in our prison industrial complex. And it's very clear that they don't work because if they did work and did deter people from doing things or provided a place and space of rehabilitation, they would actually be empty. And considering that, you know, they're building new prisons consistently and the crime rates are actually going down if you have a look at the statistics, it's just the narrative that gets pushed. Our crime rates are down, yet we're increasing prisons because we do things like demolish the public housing towers and, you know, there's such a huge housing crisis and people are in poverty and the people that are in poverty or experiencing housing insecurity will often be targeted and end up incarcerated because they've got, you know, multifaceted other sorts of things happening in their lives. And yeah, so our prison systems aren't solving social issues. We need to start focusing on social issues and supporting people's needs rather than seeing them as high risk.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, that whole, you know, there's so much need to actually be talking, you know, to people like yourself, Nina, who can speak to, you know, how this, yeah, as you said, is a prison industrial complex. It's not actually rehabilitating people, you know. As you said, crime rates are actually going down and, you know, we really need to actually focus on, you know, other alternatives to actually helping people, you know, who are facing family violence and so many other, you know, challenges as well. But can you talk a little bit to us about, you know, what the aims of the Family Violence Justice Project is and, you know, how The project engages with people who've experienced incarceration?
Sure. So FIRE is an organisation that supports trans women, gender diverse folks across Victoria in the prison system, and we also support their children with a variety of different issues. Like, we know there's, you know, lots of intersecting things: family violence, mental health, housing, AOD, and we really provide, and, you know, these sorts of terms are thrown around consistently, like person-centred, trauma-informed, holistic. and sort of for me, they sort of tend to lose their meaning because it sort of becomes this tick box. And, you know, people say that that's their practice. However, in reality, that's not actually what's happening on the ground. And so formerly incarcerated women find it really hard to engage with services because of systemic collusion. And what that means is, for instance, if a victim survivor presents to a mainstream service and indicates that there's alcohol and other drug use in the home, child protection will be called and the children will be removed. And not only is she then experiencing the family violence, but the violence will escalate because the person who's using violence will blame her for having the child removed. She will feel hugely more traumatised because she's had the children removed. And it just pertains to a infuriating, massive, dangerous situation. And so what we do is we really have a look at the person and we assess their needs and really try and support them through what they're going through. And the Family Violence Justice Project was designed because of the Royal Commission into Family Violence. One of the findings was that criminalised women are one of the highest marginalised groups that experience violence, however, are the least likely to engage in mainstream services because of those reasons. So we provide a lot of training and capacity building in the sector around misidentification, resisting systemic collusion, the intersections between child protection and criminalisation, alcohol and other drugs. And we sort of just give a really good oversight on how people can start seeing people for how they're presenting as high needs rather than high risk and get them the support that they need.
Yeah.
And also, at Flat Out, we are very, very lucky and very fortunate. I mean, you know, you hear the term nothing about us without us across the sector, and it started in the disability sector. And we're really, really true to that. So we've got lived experience, formerly incarcerated lived experience folks at the board level, and we also have them embedded as advisors or consultants across all of the different programs. So we're really led by who we're trying to serve. And so there's also, I founded a collective called FIGJAM, which stands for Formerly Incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne, but also has the double meaning, which folks probably know, and it starts with the F word. F, I'm good, just ask me.
Yeah.
Because of that shame and discrimination and all of those sort of nuances that are pushed into us continuously as being criminalised, we really wanted to also unpack that and shed a bit of light and also have a bit of a laugh, you know? It's not, you know, just to not always be so serious. And so there's probably about 30 members in that collective, 15 really active members. They meet weekly. There's a number of different projects that we work on alongside universities. We embed our expertise in research, do consultancy, presentations. And the women really, really sort of drive the work. And so there's two components of that. One is the work element and the other one is the peer support, because it's really hard for criminalised folks to find community when they're released.
Mm.
Because we move so much in the shadows and keep each other safe in community, if you're not connected to that community, it's hard to find other people who are in community that have been formerly incarcerated. And so we also provide a point of connection when people are released.
Yeah, that's so important. And, you know, creating that sense of community and having people, you know, that people can relate to and, you know, have that sense of, community and solidarity with. And you touched on, Nina, that, you know, FIGJAM gives presentations. And I know that recently you travelled to Alice Springs, Mabantua, with Fig Jam at the Reintegration Puzzle Conference. But can you tell us a little bit about that presentation, maybe some of the key points or takeaways from it?
Yeah, and I just also want to touch on just that I've been to a number of different conferences Australia-wide, and the Reintegration Puzzle Conference really focuses and elevates lived experience folks. So it's a two-day conference. However, on the very first day prior to that conference even taking place, they put on a lived experience lunch. And so all of the lived experience people that are either attendees or presenting, they all get to meet one another. So you never get lost in the crowd. And I think that that's really, really important, because as a lived experience person, the divide between lived experience and professionalism is still very real.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a place to come together and meet and greet really builds that relationships, that connection and that networking. And then there's we had a cultural workshop followed by an all-in dinner where then everybody attends. And it was just a really, really beautiful way to kick off. And so we went along, the Fijian Collective, there was 11 of us that went along. A lot of the folks were on parole, so that normally means that you can't leave the state. However, because of the safety and the work that we're doing and because of the positive relationship that we've started building with parole, it was really easy to get the women to be able to come along, which obviously also speaks volumes, because parole can be really, really challenging for some of the women, and a lot of stipulations and conditions are placed on the women, trans and gender diverse folks, when they are reintegrating into community. So that was a huge win in itself.
Mm.
And so we had a 40-minute slot, and we really spoke about how lived experience translates into professionalism and sort of all of the things that we've been doing to lead us up to where we are today, upskilling folks, what sort of engagements people have done. And so there was five women on the panel, and they each spoke to their journeys while being connected to Fig Jam.
Yeah, that sounds really wonderful, and, you know, such an amazing opportunity as well, Nina, that, you know, you were able to bring together that group of women and, you know, give them, yeah, that opportunity to, you know, participate in community and, you know, make those connections at that professional level as well. But, yeah, before we wrap up, can you tell us a little bit maybe how 3CR listeners can find out more about Flat Out's work and get involved?
Yes. So Flat Out have got a membership, and they also have a newsletter, which is awesome. It's so good. It's so we've only been running it for we've started it within the year, but it's got great content on it. Obviously we've got socials, jump on the Flat Out Facebook, Instagram, subscribe to the newsletter, you know, give us a couple of donations, because we don't get money from corrections, because if we did get money from corrections, it would actually hinder the sort of support that we try and give the women. Please donate. And what was the other question? Sorry.
I guess just how people can find out more and get involved.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, there's a number of different sort of, we've done the Homes Not Prisons podcast series with 3CR.
Mm.
We've also done the Untold Stories of Injustice with 3CR that was Fig Jam led. I can't say enough about 3CR. Like, it's such a beautiful platform. Another Fig Jam was actually interviewed yesterday. It's just, we are really, really fortunate to be able to spread our message and for you to allow our voices to be heard on radio, because I think so many different marginalised communities, like, when you hear their experiences, that's how we connect and that's how we relate. And that's how we change that stigma and discrimination. So, yeah, just want to say really appreciate you for asking me to be on the show this morning.
Yeah. Well, no, we really appreciate you coming on, Nina. And, I think it's so important to, you know, be changing the narrative and actually getting people to speak about their own experiences, you know, to really challenge what we do here in the mainstream so often.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, really appreciate you coming on, Nina, and it sounds like we've still got so much to chat about. So maybe we can have you on another time. Want to say thanks for coming on today.
Beautiful. Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You too. We've been speaking to Nina, who's the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out, about the intersection of family violence and women and gender diverse people who've been incarcerated and the organisation's work in helping women and gender diverse people reintegrate access community after prison. And you can follow at flatout.inc on Instagram for more information, and we'll be back shortly.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Have you heard about the news that's come out of the NT?
What news? Fires, floods, chicken flu, what?
No, the payouts.
Payouts?
Compensation for what you went through.
No.
Well, I reckon you should go for it. You deserve every cent and more. I'll back you. You know it.
Oh, sis, you're the best.
Yes, I am.
If you are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander and were removed from family or community in the Northern Territory before 1 July 1978 or in the ACT or Jervis Bay before 11th of May 1989, you may be eligible for the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme. If you know of a family member who was removed but passed away after the scheme was announced on the 5th of August 2001, you may be eligible to apply for redress for them. Call Link Up Victoria, VACA, on 037 002 3700 and leave a message for a callback or contact the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme on 1800 566 111.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And next up, we're going to be joined by Kath Rouse from the No Northern Incinerator campaign. Regular listeners of Tuesday Breakfast may remember that Kath previously joined us in March to tell us about the threat proposed by the proposed incinerator in Wollert, and is back to give us some updates on the campaign. And Kath is going to chat to us about the upcoming EPA decision on the incinerator, as well as the state government's recent increase to the cap of rubbish that can be burned in Victoria. But welcome back to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, Kath.
Oh, thanks so much for having us. It's just thank you. We appreciate any chance to let folk know, because this is still something that impacts so, if it goes ahead, impacts so many people, and nobody, hardly any people know still about
exactly.
it.
Exactly, yeah. And Kath, on the topic of that, could you, sort of give us a rundown, particularly for those, who haven't heard about the threat of the incinerator. Yeah, what is the proposal and what's the community threat that it poses?
Okie doke. Well, look, there's a few of these happening around Melbourne, but our particular campaign is advocating to stop the proposal to burn 10 million tonne of rubbish in Wollert. You know, it's got homes 360 degrees around it. Homes are from within 300 metres away. It's people don't know always where Wollert was, and I wasn't sure where it was placed because people think of Wollin, but Wollert is in between Donnybrook and the city. So it's not very far away from folks, you know. It's about 20K from the city. And so burning 10 million tonne of industrial, residential and demolition waste all mixed would have an impact of everyone across the north of Melbourne. And this is really bad. I think we can stop it. But first I want to say the process itself creates dioxins, those forever chemicals, as we have an extraordinary campaigner has explained to me. When you burn a whole pile of, you know, things together, things that are pretty bad by themselves, but when they're burnt together, like, you know, you'll have demolition waste, so asbestos, but you'll also have babies' nappies and all of that just all squashed in together, burned at 850 degrees, that creates dioxins, a whole range of forever chemicals, which goes in our air and goes in, then lands on the soil. So this process doesn't get rid of rubbish. It reduces to 30%, but the other 70% goes somewhere.
Yeah. No, it's really concerning, Kath. And yeah, I hadn't even thought about before, you know, what you're saying, this idea of, you know, how when you're burning these materials together as well, it's even worse. Like, yeah, it's just really horrifying to think about, you know, the environmental impact and then the impact that has on our community as well.
And I wanted to say, like, we're not alarmists. These are not allowed in Sydney or the ACT.
Yeah.
They've been banned. A very similar proposal was put forward for Western Sydney, and not only was it stopped there, but the decision was made not to have them across Sydney.
I was actually going to ask you about that. And what was the situation in the ACT as well?
In the ACT, I'm not sure if there was a proposal, but there might have been at some stage. But the ACT, especially because they're in a valley, you know, the toxicity of these projects are that it would just pollute the air to such an degree.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be allowed. So that's why it's particularly horrifying that they're allowed. These proposals are for metropolitan Melbourne with the youngest families living in those areas and often disadvantaged families. It's 65% English as a second language communities. And a lot of people who are newer migrants and migrants, so they haven't had, the community hasn't gathered together for big issues like this. And with our lack of local media and everything, we don't have the same ways. We have a whole range of Facebook Facebook groups and things like that. So the message is going out. In that specific community, but there isn't that history of people organising together.
Yeah. Well, no, I think, you know, that's why it's all the more important that, you know, you guys are getting the message out and, you know, spreading the word. And can you tell us, Kath, I know that at the end of August, that's when the EPA decision is coming up. Can you tell us, what's happening with that and, what do we need to know in the lead up?
Right. So, yes, in August 30, we were sent a notification to say on August 30 a decision will be announced by the EPA. This was strange in that the EPA said because the proponent, Cleanaway, wanted it to be the decision to be delayed till 30th of August, which puts it to after when they have to produce their financial statements. They're announcing their financial statements on August 20. So now they're putting back the decision to a Saturday. How strange is that?
Yeah.
So the EPA is making the announcement on a Saturday. So on the Sunday we're going to gather and and look at our next steps in this campaign. We'll gather and do that. But the interesting thing, now that we know it's August 30, in a planning process that I don't really fully understand, we can put planning. So there's a whole lot of permissions. There's a building permission, an operating permission from the EPA, but there's also planning permission from the planning minister. So we have till August 30 to put in submissions. You can email a submission to the planning department objecting to this incinerator. So the August 30 will also be the deadline for submissions. And of course, any time people can contact the planning minister and say, there's all this new housing. This is where they want to develop all of this new housing within 5 kilometres of this proposal. And we can contact the planning minister anytime and say, this is not on.
Yeah, definitely. Well, definitely we would encourage our listeners to, get involved and, share their thoughts and feelings about the proposal. And I know that the campaign's also having some public meetings this August. Can you tell us a bit more about them and some other ways that people can get involved with the campaign?
Yeah. So what I'll do now is broaden. So we've got our campaign, No Northern Incinerator, mm-hmm. which people can see on Facebook. And there's also a few other campaigns that are related that are having public meetings. There's another campaign for people who live in Lara. So there's a similar proposal in Lara. And this is called Say No to Lara Big Incinerator. So they'll be having a public meeting coming up. So check them on Facebook as well. They've got one in August. And now a new emerging threat, which is only about 20 kilometres from the Wollert site, is another proposal in Sunbury to do something similar. And so if people have a look in people who live around Sunbury, check out their socials, because there's a group also, and to stop the Sunbury proposal from going ahead. And look, they've just formed and they're being really strong as well. So they're two of the strong campaign groups. The third campaign group is the Lynbrook Residents Association, and they they're stopping. There's trying to be a transfer station in Lynbrook to transfer, to gather waste there that transfers to incinerators. So down in the south. So they're trying to stop that. So that's the Lynbrook Residents Association.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you so much for sharing, Kath, all those different community campaigns that are cropping up recently. And, you know, I think that really speaks to the threat of these incinerators, and it now is much bigger just than proposed incinerator in Wollert. We are seeing it across the state, so that is really and concerning.
And one thing that has happened, we put in all our submissions and everything against the Wollert one. Since all of our application process finished for the EPA, the state government has increased the cap for what would be permitted if they're allowed to go ahead, from 1 million tonne a year to 2.5 million tonne of mixed rubbish to be burnt every year. You can imagine what that's going to do to our airways, and that is 24/7, 365 days of the year. It will not go away. And so our little green dots on our air quality, will be impacted by that.
Yeah, it would be really at threat. And, No, we really appreciate you, stepping us through, Kath, the impacts. Thank you so much, Kath, for joining us this morning. And, definitely we would encourage everyone to stay tuned and, you know, find out more about the campaign and get involved in the lead up to that August 30th decision this month.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Kath. Well, we've been speaking to Kath Rouse of the No Northern Incinerator Will Alert campaign, which is fighting against a massive commercial waste incinerator in Melbourne's northern suburbs ahead of the decision at the end of August. And you can follow No Northern Incinerator Will Alert on Facebook.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's keffiyehs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
RCR Community Radio, giving the voice to community since 1976.
Up next, we've got an excerpt from Earth Matters, which first aired on the 27th of July, and Beck presented five speakers representing student women, rural women, First Nations women, women with disabilities, and older women who share their experiences of how to bring these marginalised voices into climate discussions, negotiations, and decisions to achieve better outcomes. And this is from the Women's Climate Conference held in Castlemaine earlier this year. And you can listen to the whole episode and other editions of Earth Matters at 3cr.org/earthmatters.
I'm Kelly McDonald. I'm from the National Rural Women's Coalition, and I'd just like to pay my respects to Aunty Sandra and the people of this beautiful country, and it was just such a great welcome when we first came in. I'm from Kamilaroi country, so that's in Gunnedah, northwest New South Wales. So you probably haven't heard of the National Rural Women's Coalition, but it is a not-for-profit organisation. It's one of the five National Women's Alliances now funded under the Working for Women strategy, and it's funded by Prime Minister and Cabinet. We are representing all rural, remote and regional women in all their diversity, so women with disabilities, called women, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, women of diverse genders. And interestingly enough, often I get pigeonholed as just being an agricultural woman, which I admit I am. I'm from the land. I'm a broadacre farmer, pulses, cotton, wheat, cattle. But I also am a small business owner, and the women that are actually in farming are only 2.8% of the total of rural, remote and regional women, which is about 30% of the population of Australia. So it's quite a large group of women that we try and represent. The work of the National Rural Women's Coalition is around changing and influencing policy to benefit rural, remote and regional women. So we've got our fingers in lots of different pies. So probably I'm spread a little bit thinner than butter on toast than you'd like. So I rely heavily on partnerships and working with other groups that are the specialists in the area, and also working with grassroots women. So I'm a huge fan of the benefit of the grassroots women and the strength of that grassroots place-based, because people know the best of the areas that they live in. They know, particularly when we've seen disaster and disaster response, that the best responses to those are led by the communities in which they happen in. Now, in my little town of Gunnedah, it's a population of 10,000 people. We had 9 floods in under 2 years. And the quickest response to that is the local response. I'm not far from Coonabarabran with the big fires, and it is rural people that, in my opinion, are the forefront of seeing the impacts of climate change, because it is happening in our space. Cyclones, floods, fires, and droughts. And one of my little hobby horses for those in the room is that drought is not considered a disaster, so it doesn't get that emergency funding like everything else is. And when I drove through the country yesterday, as I came through Gunnedah, through Canberra and all the way down, I noticed how dry the country is, and I know there are parts of South Australia that are still desperately in deep, deep drought. And the impacts of that on families in rural communities goes on for longer than the impact of the drought. In 2019, I was lucky enough to be at the UN for the Commission on the Status of Women. And the big push for us at that point, as you can imagine, because of the drought, was water security. In particular, water security for women. Now, the Australian government was unbelievable in their support to make sure that that became something that was agreed as part of that CSW that year. And so for me, water and water security for rural, remote and regional women is a critical part of how we survive and move forward. So I am a passionate defender of water security for our communities, for life, for sanitation. And Australia really only took notice of that in the largest drought that we'd ever had when towns on the eastern seaboard ran out of water. Because they never do, do they? It's okay for us out there if you're on a farm and you've run out of tank water or you don't have any bore water. But when it happens on the eastern seaboard where 95% of Australia's population live, suddenly they take notice of us. So the lesson for me is about making sure that our rural, remote and regional stories transcends the Great Divide or the Simpson Desert and make sure that people know of the stories of rural, remote and regional Australia and how that they can impact them.
After talking with a group of conference participants, Kelly said this.
Our group were talking about what works in terms of advocacy for climate change. So we were talking about place-based solutions, but why sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't work, and why sometimes women don't want to speak up and how we can encourage them to speak up. And that can be that when we have our meetings, at what time of day it is, and whether or not we make those places welcoming to women. And that is often around women's childcare and nurturing responsibilities. You know, often we're looking after parents and children, and so making meetings and places at times where that's open to everyone. We need those places to be safe, and we need people to have it advertised that children are welcome to these meetings so that mothers can bring their children so we can have these conversations and all voices are included. The other thing we talked about was outreach, and we had some really great examples during disasters when we've had centres where people can come in, but it's not inclusive of all people, so that we're outreach and actually going out and meeting people where they're at, whether it's a community of people or individual people, is the way that we make sure that we're looking after everybody in our community. And a community's strength and resilience is only measured by the way that we treat the most vulnerable within it. And so outreach is such an important part of making sure that we're doing that. The other things we've talked about this post-COVID is that when people don't want to come into meetings, that we've now got things like online, which most people hopefully have access to, but we can't assume that they all do. And that when we have these meetings, sometimes we have to welcome people in at where they're at and what they're doing. And I think of called women, you know, like they may not be comfortable walking into a space that looks like this if they don't know that they are particularly welcomed. And so let's make them welcome. Let's ask those people. And we take some of the things particularly that said by Claire to make sure spaces are welcome for everybody. There's also the issue that was brought up very bravely, I thought, by one of the people in their group, where there's often multiple grassroots groups working on the same issue within the same space. And often that can be that we're competing with each other for minimal funding, for minimal voice time, for minimal even participants in some space, and how that is not always to the benefit of us all. Now, we may need these individual groups because they're working on specific chunks of work, but there must be a way that we can bring everybody together, and we're thinking about how good the Congress is because it is a network of people. So it allows people to work in their groups and what they're doing, but it brings people together at events like this. Whatever you're representing, your voice can be heard here as part of a network. And we also talked about making sure that we are always encouraging young people, and that stands right from that point of bringing them in from their children, but all the way through, because it is young people that are going to action some of the things that we are talking about today.
Here's student representative Ellie Venning.
Namani Namani Napudni Ellie Venning. I acknowledge that I live and work predominantly on Kaurna country in Adelaide. So what I've just said is hello, my name is Ellie Venning in the native tongue of the people of the land that I live on. So as Mary mentioned, I am the National Union of Students' Women's Officer for the year. I'm studying at the University of Adelaide, doing a Bachelor's of Environmental Policy and Management, the major in politics. I'm also on the executive of my uni women's collective, and I'm also a board director of my student union. So unfortunately, I'm very busy, which is good. I love being able to approach these areas as a feminist and as an environmentalist, and I think these two things are very interconnected. A little heads up for my presentation will be that I'm mainly talking about what students are doing on campus and the importance of involving them in your broader discussions and also in the commentary around campuses as well. The segregation of gender in environmental courses in academia and about the eco-gender gap.
And here's the participant reporting back on Ellie Vanning's presentation.
Wow, that woman has passion. She spoke about four primary things. The first was explaining to us older ones what is eco-gender gap. It's the difference in the way that women are studying and are passionate about environmental issues. She also explained that the environmental engineering is one that women are most likely to participate in. And this is because women care. And then the next thing she spoke about was stats, that men will profound share them and we'll all go yawn. But when a woman tells a story, we all listen, because quite often it's with heart. And then the other thing that we heard was how she spent the last week in Canberra lobbying. And she's met with not just the people in her party, but she's met with all politicians and she found common ground.
Hi everyone, I'm Chloe Wegener, my pronouns are she, her. I also want to begin just by acknowledging Jar Jar Warong and really thank Auntie Sandra for her wonderful warm welcome and the balance that they've maintained here for thousands and thousands of years that we are all going to now work to try and restore together. I'm a Garawal woman. I work at the Wiyana Yuthungani Institute for First Nations Gender Justice. Wiyana Yuthungani means women's voices in Junoska's late native language Bunabub. We're based at the ANU, work quite independently within ANU, I would say. Personally, I've grown up on Kaurna country, but I now live on Wadawurrung country down in Ocean Grove in Victoria, beautiful place in the world. And like many First Nations women, like many autistic women, like many queer women, like many young women, like many women with hidden disabilities, I've grown up in a world not made for me. But like mentors through June Oscar, who's our chair, I discovered my strength in my unique voice. But I will say I am a cisgender woman. The Institute is Australia's first ever institute dedicated to advancing the rights, knowledges and leadership of First Nations women, girls and gender diverse people. And after speaking with over 2,000 First Nations women, girls and gender diverse people, it became clear to the team that First Nations women are doing the backbone of their communities, weaving together the social fabric that sustains all of us. We also learned that First Nations knowledge systems and approaches to caring for country are often overlooked in climate frameworks, despite women consistently highlighting their crucial role in this space. So the Institute's purpose is simple yet critical: to elevate these voices, their lived experiences, solutions as crucial to reconstructing more just, sustainable and enabling societies.
Chloe Wegener. And here's a participant describing Chloe's talk.
What we talked about, which was really quite inspirational, was that First Nations peoples do not see things in silos, that they see it totally integrated. So when they take their children onto the land, it's not just about understanding the land. It's about understanding everything to do with life. It's about the connections that the land gives us as people, and First Nations people in particular. I have to say, I'm incredibly envious of that capacity. And I think it's something, if we could learn as white settlers here, we would understand this land and ourselves much more than we currently do. And Chloe talked about the work that First Nations people are doing that we don't know about because it gets hidden, and First Nations women in particular are not seen in the work they're doing. They're not seen even in their own culture sometimes, let alone in our culture. And that's a major challenge for us if we're going to do it correctly. We also talked about the need for us to see First Nations people not just as making a contribution to our conversation, but as being the solution in our conversation. And I think that was a really important piece. The other thing that came up very briefly, but importantly, was the importance of treaty. And what's happening in Victoria with treaty is not just about creating treaty, but also making sure that truth is told, and that without truth being told, treaty is not understood in the same way.
That was a participant describing Chloe Wegener's talk about including First Nations women, girls and women-identified people in discussions and decisions addressing the climate crisis.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and we were just listening to an excerpt from a recent episode of Earth Matters on 27th of July, which featured some speeches from the Women's Climate Conference, specifically hearing from student women, rural women, First Nations women and women with disabilities and older women on how to bring those voices into climate discussions, negotiations and decisions. And up next, we're going to listen to a song, Eyes on Me by June Jones, who is a Naam-based alt-pop singer, songwriter, producer and shapeshifter. And this is a new release entitled Eyes on Me. Stuck in my head late night, and I'm looking for a lead pipe in the kitchen, in the study, in the dining room. Premonition, I was driving through a red light. There's gotta be more to life than this. Maybe a little touch, a little kiss. Maybe the flames of desire as they flicker like a fire in your lips. Listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Eyes on Me by June Jones. And up next, we're going to be listening to some speeches. So on Monday, 11th of August, the Free Palestine Coalition NAM organised a snap rally at the ABC headquarters in South Bank after targeted airstrikes by Israel killed six Palestinian journalists and crew. They were Anas al-Sharif, Mohammed Kriya, Ibrahim Zahra, Mohammed Aliwa, Mohammed Nufal and Mohammed Al-Khaldi. Last month, the Committee to Protect Journalists said it was gravely concerned for Anas al-Sharif's safety as he was being targeted by an Israeli military smear campaign. Al Jazeera called on the international community and all relevant organisations to take decisive measures to halt this ongoing genocide and end the deliberate targeting of journalists. At the snap rally, Palestinian activist Noor Salman read aloud the will and final message from Anas al-Sharif, who had become one of the most recognisable voices documenting the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza.
We're here today because this morning we all woke up to the most horrifying news, and we, over the past year and 8 months, We every day wake up hoping that we don't hear the death of a loved one, that we don't hear the death of another child, that we don't hear the death of more children and women and men and journalists and medics. But this morning we woke up to the atrocious news of the deliberate Israeli airstrike on a journalist's tent, Al Jazeera's journalist's tent on the grounds of a hospital, killing five journalists and media, including correspondents Anas Sharif, Mohammed Qiyata, their cameraman Ibrahim Zahir, Mohammed Nofad, and their media staff at Mu'min Alewa. That is the entire Al Jazeera crew assassinated in one airstrike. And that is a crime under international law. But Israel has committed this crime over 230 times over this past year and 8 months. It has killed multiple journalists speaking truth to power because Israel denies the entry of Western journalists, because it denies the truth telling. It does not want to show the world that we are suffering, that our people are suffering. And it comes ahead of a week of Netanyahu, who has an arrest warrant by the ICJ, that he is going to take over Gaza City and continued ethnic cleansing and the forced starvation. But I won't continue. I think our presence here today in mourning, in tears, in grief is an honorable thing, and that we honor our dead, we honor our martyrs, but more especially we're honoring the five journalists, Anas, Muhammad, Hamad, and Ibrahim. I'm gonna read Anas's last will and testament on this earth. Anas knew he was gonna be targeted. He was targeted by the IOF. They targeted him directly and pronounced and said that deliberately lied about his associations. He was a journalist. He continued to be a journalist, and he continued to shed light on the atrocities that were happening in Gaza because no one else was listening. And I hope that you listen today. Here's the will of slain journalist Anas Sharif. And I'm so sorry, but we are grieving, and this is, it ebbs and flows. This is the will. He wrote, "This is my will and my final message. If these words of mine reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. First, peace, mercy and blessings of God be upon you. God knows that ever since I opened my eyes to life in the alleys and neighborhoods of Jabalia refugee camp, I have exerted all my effort and strength to be of support and a voice for my people. My hope was that God would prolong my life so that I could return with my family and loved ones to our original hometown, Al Majdal, and occupied Ashkelon. But God's will was supreme and his judgment is final. I have lived the pain in all of its details, and I've repeatedly tasted pain and loss. Despite this, I've never hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification. May God be a witness against those who remain silent and accepted our killing, and against those who held our breath and whose hearts were not moved by the limbs of our children and women, and who failed to stop the massacre our people have been subjected to for more than a year and a half. I entrust Palestine to you, the jewel in the crown of Muslims and the heartbeat of every free person in this world. I entrust this people and its young, oppressed children who were not given the time to dream and live in safety and peace because their pure bodies were crushed by thousands of tons of Israeli bombs and missiles torn to pieces and their limbs scattered on the walls. I ask you to not be silenced by restrictions nor to be paralyzed by borders, be bridges toward the liberation of the country and its people, so that the light of dignity and freedom may shine upon our usurped homeland. I entrust you to do good for my family. I entrust you with the apple of my eye, my beloved daughter Sham, whom I have not yet seen grow up as I dreamed. I entrust you with my dear son Salah, for whom I hope to be a support and a companion until he grows strong, so that he helps me with these burdens and continue sharing the message. I entrust you with my beloved mother, whose prayers have blessed me and enabled me to reach this point. Her prayers have been my fortress and my light. I pray to God to strengthen her heart and reward her abundantly on my behalf. I also entrust you to my lifelong companion, my beloved wife, Salah Bayan. The war separated us for many long days and months, but she remained committed, steadfast, like an unbending olive trunk, patient and content. She carried the trust in my absence with all strength and faith. I ask you to gather around them and be of support to them after God Almighty. If I die, I will die steadfast in my principles. I call God to witness that I am content with his judgment, faithful to the meeting with him, and certain that what is with God is better and more lasting. O God, accept me among the martyrs, forgive my past and future sins, and make my blood a light illuminating the path to freedom for my people and my family. Forgive me if I have fallen short, and pray mercy for me, for I have kept my promise and I have neither changed nor altered. Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your prayers for forgiveness and acceptance. Anas Jamal as Sharif. Thank you.
We've been listening to Noor Salman, local Palestinian advocate, reading out the final will of murdered Al Jazeera journalist Anas El-Sharif at the snap rally outside the ABC headquarters in Melbourne yesterday evening. And next up is the events for this week. So today, 12th of August at 5 p.m. in Castlemaine, there's going to be the March for Gaza starting at the Market Building. Also tonight at 5:30 is the Defend Dissent Rally taking place at Parliament House here in Melbourne, defending the right to protest, which we've spoken to a number of different people about here on Tuesday Breakfast in previous weeks. And then finally, on the 16th of August, from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. At the Greek Democritus Workers League in at 583 High Street, Northcote, there's going to be the 80th commemoration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But we've had a really massive show today. So we started off at 7:15. Fung was joined by Lucinda Thorpe, the privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and they chatted about the latest Productivity Commission report on AI, how big tech companies are benefiting from the lack of regulation and how that impacts regular people. Then we spoke to Nina, who is from Flat Out, and Nina is the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator. And we spoke about, the importance of, elevating the voices of people who have experienced incarceration firsthand, and the intersection of family violence and incarceration. And then we spoke at 7:45 to Kath Rouse from the No Northern Incinerator campaign, with some campaign updates and the upcoming EPA decision on the incinerator, as well as the state government's recent increase to the cap of rubbish that can be burned in Victoria. And then at 8 a.m., we listen to an excerpt from an episode of Earth Matters, which first aired on the 27th of July. We heard some speeches from the Women's Climate Conference. And then finally at 8:15, we heard a recording of Noor Salman, a Palestinian advocate, speaking at the SNAP protest to defend Palestinian journalists, hearing the will and final message from journalist Anas al-Sharif. And I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Tuesday Breakfast. And up next is Accent of Women.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.